Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Carrie Gillen. I'm a host on New Books and Language, part of the New Books Network. I'm also the co-host of the Vocal Fries podcast. Today, I have Dr. Jelsey McCracken, who is an assistant professor of interdisciplinary arts and science at Dixie State University. She conducts research both on language documentation and on homeschooling and educational policy for the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. And today, I have her on to talk about her grammar of, is it Bellup?
That's how I typically say it in English, is Bellup. But in Bellup, you would say Mbelep.
I was pretty sure it was not going to be correct in the actual language. Okay, that's good to know that it's English appropriate. So welcome.
Thank you.
So why did you decide to write a grammar on any language, and then why this language in particular?
So from the very first time that I ever learned about that linguistics existed, which was probably at some point in college, and even before that, I've always been really interested in endangered and minority languages. And as soon as I found out the linguistics existed, I knew that I wanted to work on a language that had not been fully documented yet, or on an endangered or minority language. And I kind of knew even before applying to grad school that what I wanted to do was I wanted to write a grammar. To me, it seems like the best opportunities to write grammars are really in graduate school. It's such an all-consuming process. It's hard to imagine doing that while also teaching at the same time. I'm amazed at my faculty members, other faculty members who've done that. So I went to grad school knowing that what I wanted to do was write a grammar, and I tried to design my educational program so that I would be best prepared to be able to do that.
Cool. And why did you choose Bellup in particular?
So I chose Bellup. My undergrad degree was in French and math, and so I was a fluent speaker of French. So I also sort of realized that I wanted to be able to use French as a contact language. So I was looking around and exploring French colony, countries that had been colonized by the French. And so French would be a potential contact language. And one of my professors knew someone who knew someone who worked in New Caledonia. So I contacted her. That's Isabelle Brill. She worked on the language Nelemois-Nihumwak, spoken in Kumwak and Pum in New Caledonia, which is quite nearby to Bellup. So I contacted her and was like, hey, do you know of any languages that don't have any documentation on them, like nearby languages or ones that you know of in New Caledonia? And she was like, hey, Bellup, no one has gone to Bellup before. The only really trained linguist that had been there before was a Marist priest, and he had had some training in ethnography and linguistics, but not a lot. And as far as I know, oops, sorry. as far as I know, he's the only person with any training in linguistics that had been to Vella before.
Oh, wow. So it was definitely needed to have a linguist come in.
And it ended up being extremely fortuitous, because I didn't have a lot of contact with Bellama or people of Bellup with Bellama before I showed up there. But I did send them a letter, and like a few days before I actually arrived there, I got a letter back saying that they had actually made a request like multiple years prior to have an in-country linguist come and help them with their orthography development, and no one had ever come. And so they've been like, you know, they wanted a linguist, but no one had materialized. And so they were like really excited that I had just like appeared out of nowhere and been available to do that project, help them with that project. So it was just a very fortuitous meeting between the two of us.
So can you describe New Caledonia for us?
Yes. So New Caledonia is, I think, it's sort of described as like a one-of-a-kind type of colonial situation. I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not sure that I fully understand what its political status is with respect to France, but it was colonized by France in the late 1800s. Bellup actually, I would say, Bellup probably got some of the worst stuff that happened in the process of colonization happened in Bellup. So that's where they stuck the leper colony. And so they moved everybody out of Bellup onto the mainland to make way for their leper colony, which resulted in many Bellama becoming infected with leprosy, and it was pretty terrible. One of the texts that I ended up recording was a beautiful song and poem written by a musician, a Bellama musician, about the horror of the leper colony and the entire population being displaced because of that. New Caledonia is in the South Pacific. The indigenous people of New Caledonia are sometimes described as a mix of Polynesian and Melanesian cultural elements. Currently, there are about 30-some indigenous languages. Basically, each village in New Caledonia has its own language. New Caledonia is about the size of like Massachusetts, so it's like, you know, every city in Massachusetts had its own language, basically. There are two fratries, so like traditionally people would marry someone of the other fratry. Today, the indigenous populations maintain control of their tribu, which is like a reservation, like their tribal land. So they still have customary control over their land. But at various points, much like in, say, the United States, they were forbidden from leaving their tribal lands. In the south of New Caledonia, which is where most of the population is centered, that's where the capital Noumea is, the southern indigenous languages of New Caledonia, many of them are no longer spoken, but the ones that remain are severely endangered. In the north, and Bellup is the most extreme north that you can get, customary traditions are much more highly preserved and people still live in the customary way. I would say in Bellup, I would say customary traditions are the most preserved of anywhere in New Caledonia. So,
and why is that? Why is there this north-south divide?
So I think it has to do with where the population is centered. Like all the French institutions are in the south. You know, the university and all of the most of the colonists, most of the tourism is centered in the south. And then the north is just very rural. It's not very developed. And I think and Bellup is especially remote because it is an island separated from the rest of New Caledonia. And so in order to get to Bellup, getting to Bellup is very difficult. There is a passenger catamaran, which goes, I think, twice a week, and it periodically breaks down for months at a time. There is an industrial barge, which goes, I think, once a week, and it also periodically breaks down for long periods of time. And there is a commercial flight in a little tiny, like, plane. And they go twice a week, I think, but only if there's good weather. Right. And so it's really hard to get to Bellup, and it's kind of hard to leave. And so I think just that that travel difficulty is part of what makes the culture so strongly preserved. Unlike, I think, in most places in New Caledonia, young children are growing up speaking French as, like, primarily French. But in Bellup, that is not the case. Kids don't really become conversational in French until they're in the middle of elementary school.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's why that divide is there. So why was Bellup chosen, or Bellama or whatever, chosen as the leper colony?
I don't know why. If I had to guess, I would say because it was really far from where the capital was, but I don't actually know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So I was going to ask you what language you used to conduct your fieldwork in, but you've already answered that. It was French. What was it like speaking French with the Bellup speakers?
So I started out speaking French as my contact language, but as soon as I could, I tried to do monolingual elicitation as much as possible. So I did 3 field trips. The first one was like 2 months, and then 4 months, and then 3 months. And then, so I always went, in the winter to avoid hurricane season. So in between there, I was like furiously working on my grammar, and I'd had all these like texts and stories and stuff that I'd recorded, and I was transcribing them and glossing them and pulling out examples and analyzing them. So I was listening to them over and over and over. So each time I went back, I would be like way better at speaking Bellup than I had been the previous time. And by the third field trip, I was able to be like, I like to say I was like, you know, 200 level or 2000 level. Like I was not by any means a great speaker, but I could more or less conduct my elicitations and recording and be conversational mostly in Bellup. When I left, there's this amazing cultural practice, all-consuming cultural practice called La Coutume in New Caledonia, and it involves typically oratory. And I was able to give like a speech in Bellup at my like going away dinner.
Wow.
It wasn't great. It wasn't a great speech. It was like, you know, sophomore level final exam kind of speech. But
yeah, that's still great.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I found that first of all, like, I'm not a native speaker of French either. So I had a lot of like sort of translation, like, someone would tell me a Bellup word, and then they'd tell me the French word for it, and be like, I don't know what that French word is. It's some weird, obscure, like, I don't know, animal or something. And so then I have to go up, look up the French word, and then be able to figure out what the Bellup word was for it. And so I'm sure there's some amount of, like, playing telephone kind of errors that have been introduced into the data that way. But
that's always the case.
Right. The more that I was able to speak Bellup, the better everything went. Because I was able to, like, you know, hear a stream of speech and to be able to pick out the Bellup words that I hadn't heard before and to be able to ask what those words meant. I'd say also, the way that Bellama currently speak Bellup involves quite a lot of code switching, or I would characterize it actually as stable diglossia.
Can you explain what that is?
So when people are speaking about informal contexts related to French institutions such as education, Catholicism, government, technology, that kind of stuff, they'll typically speak more French. And when they are talking in contexts that relate to stuff about their families, about Bellup cultural practices, and traditional institutions like the chefferie, the chieftainship, and traditional governance structures, they'll speak more Bellup. And but every day there's sort of a mix between the two. And so I actually found that I would slip in, when I didn't know a Bellup word, I would slip in the French word, but with all the Bellup morphology attached, which is how Bellama typically code switch. And when I did that, people would be even more impressed by my Bellup speaking ability. Because they'd be like, wow, not only can you speak Bellup, but you can code switch right.
Yeah, that is a skill for sure. It's really cool. So you sort of told us all this already, but how long did this process take you? So you had these few months long fieldwork sessions, but what about the rest of the project?
So the rest of the project in between the fieldwork is I was back in the States. I was at Rice, and I think I was even taking a couple of classes. But I was primarily working on my dissertation. And so that was, so I had like 6-7 months or so between field trips. And I spent, I think, 1 year I wrote like 4 chapters, and then the next year I wrote 4 chapters or something like that. And then the following year I massively revised all the chapters that I'd already written. But I was doing like, I don't know, like a chapter a month or something. It was really intensively writing.
Yeah, that's pretty quick, actually. So what are some interesting things about this language that you found?
This is a super cool language. It kind of turned out to be perfect for me, because my interests lie in morphosyntax, and that's where all the cool stuff is in Bellup. So I was very, very tickled by that.
Maybe explain what morphosyntax is, because not everyone's going to know.
So some languages have a lot more complexity in the number of sounds that they have and the distinction between the sounds. Bellup doesn't have a huge number of sounds. I think it's only like 18 consonants and 5 vowels, depending on how you count, which is a pretty small number. Some languages have way more sounds than that. And so it wasn't super hard to learn to make most of the sounds. I mean, I'm certainly not perfect at it, but I didn't have to like learn to distinguish between different tones or distinguish between sounds that I had never heard before. Most of the complexity in Bellup comes from the way that words are constructed and the way that words parts of words are combined to make larger words or combined to make phrases and clauses and sentences. And one of the interesting things about Bellup is that the definition of what is a word in Bellup is very it's difficult to pin down. So there's a lot of languages in the region actually that don't even have a word for word. Bellup doesn't have a word for word. It only has a word for name. So to ask what the word is for something, you say, what's his name? Which is, so like the most word-like things are like nouns, or a verb, and like people can tell you what's the name of that. But when you get into anything sort of more grammatical than that, like, a word for like I or you or me or he or she, words for like, past tense like did or will, or words for directions like up or down, all of those things in Bellup are not they're not words per se. They're more, I call them formatives in my grammar, but they're sort of like parts of words, incomplete words. And in order to create a full sentence, you have to combine a bunch of these sort of incomplete words together, and it creates this sort of larger conglomeration of partial words. There's quite a lot of clitics in Bellup, which are sort of things that have like are partway between an affix and a word. And there's also this very interesting thing of where you, like, in a lot of languages, you try to break things down into sort of constituents, like a set of words or sounds that you can sort of say together as an intonation unit. Like if you stop in the middle, people would be confused, but if you say the whole thing, it's like a full, complete utterance. And the interesting thing in Bellup is that constituency is hard to determine because of all these little word parts. Like a thing that might be a full, complete sentence, you might not be able to break it down further than that into like individual words. There's like a disconnect between the types of things that you can say by themselves and the types of things that go together grammatically. So like I have a part in my grammar where I break down this sentence into phonological words. So that's words that can be said on their own, and then grammatical words. So words or part words that group together. And there's basically no one-to-one correspondence between those things. So that completely makes sense why Bellup wouldn't have a word for word, because what our conception is of a word is a thing that you can say by itself and it has like a conventionalized meaning. And in Bellup, those things don't line up.
Right. It's interesting because, so I've worked a lot on what are called polysynthetic languages, languages that have very complex structures, but basically one word can be an entire sentence. But the still, like, the what counts as a word is, I mean, sometimes it's confusing, but it's not as confusing as what sounds like for Bellup, for sure.
Yeah, and like, I tried various techniques to try to get people to tell me what their sense of, like, what a word was. I'd be like, so if you missed sort of the last half of what someone said, how would you say, you know, can you repeat that word, right? And mm-hmm. They'd be like, oh, I would just say, can you repeat that portion of what you just said? It's like, you can't really divide it into words in the way that, yeah, say English does.
That's really interesting. So what do you think this says about like language in general, or even, you know, about English wordhood? Is there anything that we can say about what words really are?
So I think really what it says is that we have to recognize that what we think of as a word isn't universal. Right. That the qualities that we think of that go along with wordhood, that they are not always like that. They just happen to occur together in our idea of words. That they are not intrinsically linked to one another, and that in languages like Belup, those different qualities that we associate with wordhood can operate independently of one another.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. That was actually my favorite part of your grammar. It's just like how complicated wordhood is, and it must have been difficult to unpack all of that.
Yeah, if you go and look at the grammars of some of the closely related languages in Northern New Caledonia, you find that people are seeing the same sorts of things, these little partial word things, and people just like don't really know how to interpret them. It's like some people will categorize them all as individual words, and then the language is sort of categorized as very isolating, like one word per one meaning per word. And then other people will categorize them all as affixes, and so it's like very agglutinating characterization of the language. And it's really coming from the fact that like the analytical framework that we have of dealing with this of words just doesn't really map well onto languages of Northern New Caledonia.
Right. Yeah. And so maybe there's something missing from our theory to begin with. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I noticed also there was an interesting pattern of noun classes. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of languages in the Pacific Rim area that categorize noun classes based on possession. So Belup has, I think four noun classes, right? And then the way that those noun classes are characterized is whether or not they can participate in one of two possessive constructions. So in order to say like my hand or my sister or my dog or my house, a noun can either be dependently possessed or inalienably possessed, meaning that there's no way to separate the possessor from the thing that they possess. I mean, you could cut it off, but it would still kind of be theirs. Like, my hand belongs to me. It doesn't belong to anybody else. Even if you cut it off, it's still my hand, right? So in order to say hand, you can't say it without saying who the possessor is. There's no sort of generic word for hand. Even the generic word for hand, ad or an, means someone's hand, his hand or her hand or their hand. You can't just say hand. And then there's another form of possession, sort of the alienable possession or the independent possession, where it's the type of object or the type of thing that can be passed around from person to person. Like, it might be, a phone, or a basket. Although baskets typically are all, are dependently possessed also. But it's hard to think of maybe an animal or plant or something like that. Although if a plant is the type of plant that you might plant in your yard, then it participates in dependent possession. So the types of objects that participate in this independent possession are ones that, well, it's often used for like Western like imports of objects. But the types of objects that you wouldn't typically think of as having an owner. So some nouns can only, you can only say the noun if you say who the possessor is. Some nouns, you can, they have an unpossessed form that's like basket. So basket is tolam. You could talk about just a generic basket, but anytime it has a possessor, you'd have to use the dependent possession form. So tolambang would be my basket, but there's no way to say the basket of someone else in a, in the independent possession form. And then there are some nouns where they have, they can be possessed both dependently and independently. So home or a village can be possessed in these two different ways. So you could say puimwang when you're talking about my home, but when you're talking about like the village of Ono, you'd say puimwa li Ono. And so it's like this, the word for home or village can be dependently possessed when it's referring to this more like the thing that is inseparable from me. Whereas it can be independently possessed when it's referring to a possessor, like a name that could change. And then there's the fourth class of nouns, which is ones that can only be participate in this independent construction. So they can only, they don't have a form that indicates that they can be dependently possessed.
Cool. It's really interesting and complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So most nouns, well, many nouns will have multiple forms, like base forms, depending on who their possessor is. Right. So like the base word for a noun will be different depending on who it's possessed by.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So are there any other interesting features of Balab?
Well, I think all the features of it are very interesting. But I think one of the other something that might be meaningful to the community of linguists is that Balab doesn't really have complement clauses. This is complement clauses are something, so a clause appearing inside as another clause, as an argument of a clause. And this is something that some schools of thought and linguistics consider to be sort of an essential element of human language. And Balab doesn't really have it. In order to denote the meaning that that many languages typically use complement clauses for. So they complement clauses are typically used for something where something that is seen, something that's believed or thought, like I think that blah, or I saw that my neighbor was arriving, or I believe that the sky is blue. Each one of those is like sort of a person conceptualizing something as a conceptualizing an idea as a noun kind of a thing. But Balab doesn't do that. Balab would say instead, I think, and the sky is blue.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So formally, in terms of the words that are being used, it's no different from just a conjunctive clause, like something and something else. There's right. like six or seven different ways to say and That may be an exaggeration. It may be five.
still a lot.
Quite a few ways to say and so each one of these ways to say and also has a meaning when it's used with what we'd typically think of as complement clauses in other languages. So there's one word for and that's used after verbs of perceiving, and there's another one that's used sort of in the types of situations where you might see a subjunctive in Romance languages. But each one of those words only means and there's no distinction between the clause that it follows it and just a regular finite clause.
Really interesting. And yeah, somewhat unusual. Definitely somewhat unusual. So what? Let's say someone has decided that they want to follow in your footsteps and write a grammar. Where would you tell them to look for a language to document?
Well, I think that to the best of my knowledge, Papua New Guinea is one of the most linguistically diverse places and has had relatively little documentation work done there. I think there's quite a few places in Oceania where the documentation of the languages has not there's lots of gaps, right, of languages that maybe there's been a small survey of them, maybe there's a little bit of phonological or grammatical, like basic word order type knowledge, but no one has ever spent, you know, a lot of time intensively digging into that language and describing its structures. And I mean, of course, there's many other places in the world that are in the same boat. So
yes, definitely.
But I'm most familiar, obviously, with Oceania. And I think that a lot of these languages are out there, and we maybe know these languages exist, but no one has taken the time to like really analyze them fully.
Right. And what do you think the main reason is that these languages have not been fully documented?
I mean, I think a lot of reasons, sort of systematic colonial oppression being one of them. But I think also just, I think this has advanced quite a lot from when I was writing my grammar 10 years ago, but, my feeling at the time was that, a lot of linguistics programs, were focused a lot on sort of analyzing languages that we already know a lot about, and that there's that there wasn't that people trying to seek out and find new information from languages that we don't already know a lot about, that there wasn't a lot of impetus for that, at least in the U.S. And I think as more and more people sort of realize that, it's become more of a trend that more and more linguists are seeing the value in analyzing languages that we don't already know a ton about. And that like those languages are going to really, sort of reveal that a lot of things that we thought were language universals and universals about humans and human minds and human societies are really not, that those are just sort of accidents of the languages that we've already happened to analyze.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was just going to ask you that. So why do these languages matter? But maybe you can answer that anyway. So why does it matter that we document these languages?
So there's so many reasons why it matters, but I would say first and foremost, the reason why it matters is that these languages are important to the people who speak them. And, your language, the languages you grow up in your family speaking and hearing, and all of your traditional stories, all of your traditional knowledge, all of your cultural practices are bound up in your language. And that's not to say that you can't continue those cultural practices in a different language, but the people who speak these languages find them to be valuable. And I think it's for those of us who have never had to look very far for any piece of media that we wanted written in our own first language. For those of us who, you know, maybe read a bunch of children's books in our native language and went to school in our native language and met our potential future spouse in our native language and, you know, get to talk to people in our native language on the bus and at the grocery store every day. It can be hard to recognize how incredibly meaningful and important it is to be able to speak your own native language and to participate in the cultural practices that are embedded in that language and that language developed out of. And so I have a beautiful foreword in my book from one of my consultants, Philippe Tanuin, who is the person in Bellup who has spent the most time trying to catalog and document his language. And his foreword, I asked him to record a foreword for my grammar about sort of his message to people, you know, several generations down the line who might be looking at this grammar or trying to think about learning the language. And his message was just so beautiful and poignant. And he's like, you know, this is the language of your ancestors, you know, all of those people who have gone before you. And like, this language connects you with them. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's the most important reason for why it's important to study these languages.
That's really beautiful. this has been really great. Is there any like last message you want to leave for the listeners? Is there something really important about the language, Bellup, or the people who speak it that you haven't already talked about?
So I'd really like to talk about La Coutume, that's okay. La Coutume is an embedded set of cultural and linguistic practices that is found throughout New Caledonia. And to me, La Coutume was probably the most challenging aspect of my fieldwork, even though it wasn't specifically linguistic in nature. And that's because La Coutume is essentially an economic system, like a non-market-based economic system that is also created and reinforced by linguistic oratory. And the way that it functions is anytime you are having any sort of personal interaction with some, like anytime you're asking permission to visit somewhere, going to someone's house, asking them for a favor, apologizing for something, sort of acknowledging a social relationship, there is a gift giving process involved. So the closest that we get in the US to this is like a birthday party kind of a thing, a birthday gift. But the gift giving in New Caledonia and in Belop specifically is just so pervasive. It is like gift giving is the basis of the economic system. And so these gifts sort of create and reinforce relationships between people. But the gifts themselves, as Belma will tell you, the gifts themselves is not important. The gift is just a gesture. What is important is the words that you speak over the gift that are sort of creating and reinforcing the relationship. And it's basically a speech genre. In the speech genre of Kutum, it has like certain parts, certain oratorical parts. Like you, there's a certain sort of bodily posture that you're supposed to assume, and a way that your voice is supposed to sound when you're doing a Kutum, you know, there'll be an intro, and then there'll be sort of the meaty part of what you're trying to say, and then there'll be a conclusion, and then your interlocutor has to respond in a certain way. And this sort of speech practice that's embedded in the economic system is something that I had to learn imperfectly, certainly. But in order to, like, in order to seem like basically like in order to have relationships with people in Belop the way that that they understand relationships, I had to learn this gift giving system and this oratorical system.
How successful do you feel that you were at that?
Not super successful. There's still a bunch of stuff that I really, it's so complex. And it's also, at least in public, it's primarily practiced by men. So there was a bit, it's also practiced sort of in private by women. But there was a bit of a like gender disconnect between, what I was trying to do and the types of speech that I was supposed to give in that speech genre. But I certainly, I became really familiar with this completely novel way of conducting social relationships. And that was, I think even more than the actual language, that was the most sort of mind-blowing part of my fieldwork.
Right. You know, at first you sort of reminded me a little bit of what happens in North America with many indigenous communities here that I'm familiar with. But the more you described it, the more I was like, no, this is a very different kind of thing. I'm very fascinated, but it does sound very difficult to navigate for people like us.
yeah,
that's really cool. Thank you for describing that.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans to go back?
I do. It's very vague though at this point. So right now I'm preparing. I finally got some copies of my grammar in my hands. I'm preparing to send them to the Belma, as I promised I would. I don't think they're going to find them super useful because they're written in English. Most Belma don't speak English.
Right.
But at least they'll have something, some sort of tangible evidence that I wasn't just shining them on the whole time. and the language committee, who I worked closely with, helping them sort of develop an orthography system, which was really challenging because of the word thing. Mm-hmm. If you don't know where, if words aren't really a thing, it's really hard to figure out where to put the spaces between words. So I worked with them, and what they really wanted was a dictionary. And so I made that part of my project, as I sort of have promised them that I'm going to make them a dictionary. Now that the grammar's done, I can sort of start that project in earnest. And so hopefully at some future time, who knows how long from now, I'll have a dictionary and I can go present that. My thought was that I would go and present that in person.
That's a really good plan. It's really nice. So they're not going to be able to read the English parts, but what about the Belip parts? Do they read their language?
There had been a lot of work on sort of grassroots work on trying to develop a writing system before I got there, and that's why they wanted a linguist to come and help them. Mm-hmm. They had already developed an alphabet in, I think, the late 90s. And so, and this is primarily the teachers at the primary school, because they are the ones, like, these are kids who are speaking Belip as their first language. They're entering primary school only speaking Belip. And these teachers are trying to teach them literacy and stuff. They're trying to teach them literacy in their first language, but it's really hard to do that when you don't have a standardized orthography.
Right, yeah.
But the teachers developed an alphabet, and most of the like classroom posters and stuff are handmade by them and written in Belip language. Other instances of Indigenous writing that I've seen is people will write up song lyrics, and like at a public event, if everyone's going to be singing a song, sort of like a songbook kind of a thing, they'll have the song lyrics so everyone can remember which verse they're on. Mm-hmm. And people will text to each other in Belip. And sort of anytime people are doing, like, this is back to the diglossia situation again, like when people are doing cultural related activities, family and cultural stuff, they often have cause to write, and they will do so in Belip without any sort of standardization, because that doesn't exist. So my hope is that being able to see how I've written the Belip examples in my grammar will at least be somewhat of a help towards that.
Yeah.
Towards the standardization. Before I left, I did give them, like, you know, we sort of co-developed, these are some of the rules that we're going to use for the orthography, for the where to write the spaces and stuff. And so before I left, I gave them, like, you know, here's a couple pages of rules that we've developed together. And then hopefully seeing a bunch of examples in the grammar will also be helpful in some way towards that.
Okay, so they'll be able to read at least some of it, which is helpful. Not fully helpful, but helpful. Is there any thought about maybe translating it into French?
Yeah, I'd really like to get it translated into French. I don't think that I can do that myself. It's best to have it's best to have someone who's a native speaker of French,
I think,
translate it into French. So I have some plans to find a some sort of a grant to pay a translator.
Oh, cool.
To translate it into French. But if you've got, if you or any of your listeners have ideas about grants that would be good for that, I'd love to hear about them.
That's a good question. I don't have any thoughts on that because I haven't had to translate anything like that before. But yeah, if anyone knows, definitely let us know. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It was so interesting. I feel like I learned so much. Yeah, I'd already learned a lot just looking, like, reading through your grammar, but talking about it, it's so much richer.
Yeah, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you and, you know, geek out a bit about language and Belma people.
I love geeking out about language. It's a little bit much for most people. All right. Well, thank you so much. And talk again soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you.